This is the best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Boom! What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio, coming to you from Southampton, New York, site of the U.S. Open, the 118th U.S. Open, and in a word, carnage. I mean, just carnage. Man, you name the player who you've heard of before, and with the exception maybe of Jason Duffner, who early on is one under. Maybe Ian Poulter, who, if you follow him on Twitter, you probably don't like him. Yeah, like, with those as the exception, I mean, it is, this tournament right now is run as being led by Russell Henley, Brian Gay. Dustin Johnson has hit all of his four fairways in regulation and has avoided some of the carnage. But, man, the big names, I mean, you're talking about Tiger Woods with a 7 to begin the U.S. Open, and that is not a par 5 on the first hole. So, you know, look, it was bad early, and you expect it to get worse late, as it did rain yesterday. They thought it would soften up the greens, but this is just a hard, hard test of golf, and it's windy, and it's getting drier. It's long. It's getting more and more difficult. In a word, carnage. I mean, actually, if you look at the bottom of the leaderboard, it might be more interesting than the top of the leaderboard. All right, so I read you some of the names at the top. You look down at the bottom, and you're like, man, well, they might as well go home. I mentioned Tiger Woods through only four holes is four over. But it gets much, much worse. Jordan Spieth finished his round with a 78. Jason Day, 79. Rory McIlroy, 80. Remember, par is 70 here. Rory McIlroy, 10 over. This was supposed to be great for the Irish kids. Great for the Euro players. Bump and run golf. It's windy. Ooh, it has been absolute carnage. And the difference is, to this point, the greens have played much more fairly than they played in 2004. It's early. It's not expected to rain. It's going to get harder and harder. And, man, is it bad. I mean, it's just bad. And I do wonder if you get to the point. It's like my favorite golf tournament. My favorite golf tournament, I used to be one called the International. The International was played in Denver, Colorado. They did something called the Modified Stableford System. The idea of the Modified Stableford System was it would reward you an extra point if you got an eagle. In other words, going for it is rewarded. I don't know. There's never been a Stableford system used in a major tournament. Why the Modified Stableford System? Point is that the Modified Stableford System, the old International, which is now a defunct tournament on the PGA Tour, to me, that was like Big 12 football. And this is like SEC football. I'm not, the U.S. Open is, well, it's the truest test of golf. I'm not denying that. You and I would probably, if you shoot in the high 80s, low 90s, you'd shoot 110, 115, playing it down from the tips. Easy. Easy. But this is like the U.S. Open getting back. PGA has started to trick up their golf courses the past couple years, and the U.S. Open goes, oh, yeah? The USGA, oh, yeah? Check this out for a second. I mean, man. And look, Tiger hasn't been great, but he has hit all of his fairways. Like, the flaw to Tiger has always been, you know, in major tournaments, when he doesn't play well, either he's not healthy, or maybe more accurately, he's inaccurate with his driver. Whether it's been driver or three wood, he hadn't had a problem with it. But the best iron player to ever play the game is having some problems there, has not hit a green in regulation, and here we are. Man, what utter carnage. Other thing is, this is a, look, it's a great spectator event if you're a spectator on TV. I don't know, Ryan Music, you're watching, you and Ramos are watching it back in Los Angeles, correct?
That's correct.
All right, so what does the course look like? If you had to, if you took a snapshot of what you think the course looks like on TV, what it must look like in person, what would that be?
Well, the one thing that's been hard to tell on TV is the greens, and like you said, how quick they can be, and sort of the one word that we only use in golf, the undulation. There's a yes. couple of shots that as soon as they hit the green, you're like, oh, that could look pretty good. And then all of a sudden, they just skip all the way back off to the back of the green and towards the edge of like the rough area. That's one of the things that's been hard to tell is exactly after the shot is hit, how it will then land and roll in relation to where the hole actually is.
And look, the camera angles and all of the tech stuff that Fox does where you have yards to the hole, the apex of the height, the speed, the exit velo, if you will, of the golf ball, and the wind, like all of that is fantastic. And they are doing some great panning shots to give you kind of a sense of what the course is like. But I don't think it gives you a sense of what the course is like. Like I've never been to Augusta, but everyone is like, man, you wouldn't believe how hilly it is. You wouldn't believe how much walking there is. And then this one, which is in kind of – it's all kind of in a confined space, like links-style golf course. But it is really hilly. It is really long. It is really windy. And, you know, obviously I haven't played the greens. Dan Beyer, who joins us, can obviously be with us all weekend long here and is hoping to get the win the lottery to play the do you win or do you lose the lottery if you have to play Monday?
That's a very good question. The way that it looks, like you're going to be on the losing end if you have to play this beast, because I don't understand on how an amateur could come out here and play the course in this conditions, a with this wind, Doug, but we're already starting to see if you're either you're here or you're watching at home, you're starting to see some brown spots maybe pop up on the green. To keep the ball within 10 feet of the hole on any shot that's outside of 50 yards is almost a miracle. I mean, balls are just rolling out and it's firming up. I don't know how any amateur could compete on a field like this, and we're seeing how the pros are dealing with it today.
I mean, you're talking the best of the best. Like the names I mentioned who put up huge numbers mm-hmm. are people's favorites to win this thing. Like Rory McIlroy, to a man, you're like, man, Rory's got a shot. Rory's got no shot. No shot. I mean, the field would have to so massively come back to him. And there's just not a setup to which you're going to be able to score on
sure.
this thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you're done after day one, even before you're like, all right, just keep the G5 hot for tomorrow. As soon as I finish my round, I'll be flying home.
And when players arrived yesterday and were here at the facilities yesterday, it was a cloudy, it was wet. So if you teed off early on Thursday, Doug, you were thought to have the advantage. Well, now for all the players that played early this morning, the lowest score out there is 69. Sure, Russell Henley is at 3-under, Brian Gaze at 2-under, but -1 is going to end up leading the tournament.
Yeah.
And
it may just be
Scott Piercy and Ian Poulter after the day, because I have no idea how anybody can keep it this low in these conditions.
Yeah, now the wind is really starting to whip. Now, the one thing, of course, that will come back is if you started in the morning today, you're in the afternoon tomorrow.
Yes.
And there's not expected to be rain, so it will be – you would think it would be more difficult, and
yeah.
The old water will find its level. So if you shoot a lower number in the afternoon today, which to this point only Dustin Johnson is sticking around to do, you'd think you'd be in better shape tomorrow. But, I mean, it's nuts to watch. I guess the question I have to you, Dan, because you're much more into golf. It's not that I'm not into golf. I love it. But you're much more into it than I am, is this a fun watch? Is this what we like? Every year is like, oh, the USGA is so hard, and it's the truest test of golf. But like, yeah, it's kind of like watching SEC football, man. Whereas I like watching the Big 12. It might be 77-70, but at least I'm entertained.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I think the part that makes this difficult is we aren't seeing any great shots, because great shots are made to look average. And that's the one thing, like if you can understand if a guy hits it in the rough on a drive and has to hack it out into the fairway and ends up making a bogey or a double, that's something that you and I can relate to and fans want to see. But when guys are hitting great shots and not being rewarded for it, that makes it a grind for not only for the players, but I also think for the viewer.
I just texted Scott Stallings, who finished, I believe he finished close 10 to 10 over.
Yeah.
I think he was 10 over. He's working out at the gym. He's going to pop up on this here, either end of the hour or top of next hour. He did not have the worst score. Scott Gregory,
yes.
Who is the British amateur champion in 2016, he shot a 92. 22 over par, a 92, which to this point is the worst score by 9 strokes. Nine. So I guess the question, like, do you even hang around tomorrow? Do you do something like, do you just try stuff? Do you tinker with your swing? Like, what do you do tomorrow?
You hang around because, yeah, he's not going to win it, but you hang around because there's other players in your group, and if you can play as a threesome, that's better than a pairing that you may have to wait longer. You'd put your other playing partners in a bad spot if you just withdrew now.
Music.
He had 4 pars on his card today. The rest were bogeys or worse.
Music, what do you got for us?
So in football, like, you know how sometimes in the later parts of the season we'll see those snow games? And it sort of seems to level the playing field, right? Because unless you're like a run-heavy team, it becomes really hard to pass the ball. And that's where you'll see those really low-scoring games. Like, they'll be like 10-7. When the course is this tough, Dan, I remember you said this earlier, like, how can an amateur compete? Doesn't it almost kind of level the playing field because you know no one out there is going to be just absolutely locked in on, like, 7 under par? Like, if everyone's going to barely be plus one or even one under, doesn't it sort of make it a more even playing field for everyone else to compete?
I think it takes some of the skill out of it.
Yeah.
Because now you're just hoping that your ball stops. That is, if it's too tough, it levels the playing field because the best of the best aren't being rewarded for their shots.
Well, if you're long, you're in good shape. If you're long, but you better be straight. And that's why, you know, Dustin Johnson is long, and to this point he's been straight. If you can do that, it is a different course because you can play a higher iron. You can have more spin on it. You got a better chance. You still kind of have to be lucky about it. But yes, I agree. Look, the premise of what you're saying is absolutely accurate, which is in an effort to give us, hey, this is such a tough test, it should give us the best golfer. It actually kind of backfires.
Yeah.
In that it does eliminates a lot of the guys with a ton of skill, creative shot making, because it really is about being straight, you know, fairways and greens. And then you got to get a little lucky with things biting. But you would have thought fairways and greens, that'd be Jordan Spieth, but he was awful today too.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is you had that group of Phil, Jordan Spieth, and Rory McIlroy shoot 25 over par. I don't think anybody would have thought that coming in. People were looking at a winning score, guys, of -4, -5 at the start of this. And I don't know if we will get an under par winner. I don't know. We're going to have 2 people under par, I think, at the end of day one. So to have a winner under par, I think, is a lot to ask.
All right, so Tiger's going to have his first shot at birdie as on the par 5 fifth hole. He just chipped up. He was just short of the green, chipped up, and he's, I don't know, he looks like he's about 8 or 9 feet away for his first birdie putt of the day. Tiger, again, 4 over through 4 on the green. On the green, laying three, on the fifth hole. So we'll continue to update you. Like, look, the story is no one that you know outside of Dustin Johnson is playing particularly well, and even Dustin Johnson is just starting off, but he did just birdie the fourth hole, so he's right there kind of in the early leaderboard. And it is windy, it is dry, and it will get faster and harder as the weekend proceeds.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Chris Mannix is an NBA insider for Yahoo Sports. Make sure to check out his show Sundays from noon to 3 Eastern time alongside NBA champion Caron Butler here on Fox Sports Radio. He'll be joining us momentarily. We'll get the updates that you need to give you a sense of LeBron James. Now, we told you 2 days ago when the story broke. 2 days ago, a story that ESPN started running last night, I told you exactly what happened, where there was a diss track between Lonzo Ball and Kyle Kuzma. I told you my Laker guys said that they're best friends, but they've been asked to tone it down on social media, that's not the behavior of franchise caliber players that either one of these guys want to be. So it's a, hey, look, it's not that big a deal, but it could spin into something worse. I don't know if that sort of maturity or the idea that lacks maturity would in any way nudge LeBron James to not get to Los Angeles. Let's ask Chris Mannix from Yahoo Sports and Fox Sports Radio. He joins us now. does this affect in any way LeBron's decision?
I think it doesn't help, which was the impetus behind, you know, LA telling them to cool it. I mean, you want to, you know, give off the vibe of a winning franchise, and, you know, having two of your key players, you know, acting kind of like goofballs doesn't really give off that vibe, especially, you know, when you're competing with a Houston Rockets team that's going to sell him on a chance to win right away, or, you know, even a Cavs team, you know, that could sell him in different ways. It just, the optics of it are bad, and I think that's why that was the biggest reason why the Lakers told them to knock it off.
All right, where are we with things? What are you hearing in terms of where his process is?
Not a lot, Doug, to be honest. I mean, he's clearly in the middle of it right now and working some things out, and I know his team has talked to him a little bit about, you know, the different scenarios that could be on the table, but I don't think he's that far down the road yet. I wouldn't doubt that there's been communication between LeBron and Paul George, LeBron and Chris Paul at this point. I mean, that's pretty easy to assume, but everything else, it's just too early.
All right, speaking of Paul George, there's now renewed thoughts that Paul George would consider signing in Oklahoma City. Like, that is just so vague to me. All right, like Paul George being an idiot not to consider not opting out, or not to, especially coming off of a knee, or not to be an idiot to not, you know, think about a new contract where he can make more money and stay in Oklahoma City. I don't feel like that's earth-shattering. Do you?
No, and look, I said this, you know, on the air last weekend and on TV earlier this week. I mean, I never believed that Paul George leaving, even with the disappointing outcome of the season, I never believed him leaving was anywhere close to a lock. I mean, you know, Russell Westbrook, from, you know, during the season as recently, relationship between Russell and Paul George is really good. I mean, they're working out this summer together in Southern California. You know, there's a pretty good bond, you know, between those guys. So, and Oklahoma City too. You know, one thing they've made clear is that, you know, Paul George can sign whatever contract he wants. I mean, if he wants the 5-year full max, he can get it. If he wants a short term deal, they'll work that out with him too. They're being very flexible in Oklahoma City with contract terms, and I think that is appealing to Paul George as well.
There was a report, a couple reports to get to, one from the Ringer that said, everybody was trying to talk Brian Colangelo. Everybody in that organization was trying to talk Brian Colangelo out of drafting Markelle Fultz. I find it curious that this only comes out after Brian Colangelo is gone.
Yeah.
What do you make of that report?
He was not the only one in the organization that wanted Markelle Fultz. I mean, I can say that with certainty. Now, you know,
he was what? I'm sorry, you cut out for a second. He was, no, or was not the only one?
No, he was not the only one in the organization that wanted Markelle Fultz. There were others there. I don't. Maybe it wasn't a consensus, but it wasn't Brian Colangelo versus the world. I can tell you that much. Now he wanted him, Doug. He wanted Markelle Fultz. No question about it. That's why he was willing to do that deal with Boston. But he wasn't alone in that charge.
No, I had heard the same as well, and, you know, I've heard from other teams that worked out all of those guards, and they thought that Markelle Fultz was the best of those guards, you know, the bevy of guards that came down the pipe last year. I just, this is one of those deals to which, now, what it does say, though, is, one, obviously everybody thinks Jason Tatum is better and has a chance to continue to be better, and two, boy, I think that hurts Markelle Fultz heading into year two. Like, whatever hope you have for him in his career, it gives you the sense that guys are turning on Colangelo after he's gone, but also turning on Markelle Fultz. Is that a fair assumption to make?
Yeah, that's a fair assumption to make. I mean, look, there are legitimate, you know, concerns about Markelle Fultz of where he's going to be at mentally with this process. I mean, he may turn out to be a good player. It just may not happen in Philadelphia. There may be too much damage done, you know, both, you know, for himself, you know, doing what he did last year and going through all he went through last year. And now with all this stuff, I mean, I don't think they move on from by any stretch. I mean, they're going to see what they can do with him next season, but I don't know that this is necessarily fixable in terms of him getting to reaching his sort of max potential. You know, Brett Brown being there helps because Brett, you know, certainly is an inspiring figure in that organization. All the players like him, but I don't know. I mean, it all depends who they hire next and how that works out.
Let's go to the Boston story, which had them offering a trade up for Kawhi Leonard before the February trade deadline. All right, I have two takeaways from that. One is that the Spurs aren't trading Kawhi Leonard, right? Like they had a chance to move on. Maybe it's because it's February. Maybe their feelings have changed. But I feel like they're not adjusting. And two, I can't believe anything Danny Ainge says, because he's constantly trying to stay ahead of the curve. He is not content, even with the team that's likely to be favored in the East next year. And proof is they tried to make a trade for Kawhi Leonard.
Well, I mean, one thing you have to know about Boston, Doug, is that they make offers all – like Mike Zarin, their assistant GM, is one of the most active assistant GMs I've ever known. I mean, he makes these offers. And I'm sure whatever they offered San Antonio, I don't know what it was. I had heard months ago that they called. It just never went anywhere. I'm sure it was a low-ball offer. And they expected maybe a counter, and that would increase the dialogue. But as Woj reported, there was no counter offer. So Boston – you're trying to get something for cheap is not at all surprising. And I still think that they're content with this current group. Doing it something in February is different than doing something now. And everything I've heard from over the last few weeks is that they really want to go into this season, not just with their stars intact, but with Terry Rozier still there, with Marcus Smart back. I mean, there's a real belief in Boston next year that they can make a run at it. And that's why I think they'll bring everybody back.
All right, what about where are we with Chris Paul? Is he, you know, there was thought that he's automatically re-signing. Is that an automatic? Is that a given?
I think the most difficult part of the Chris Paul negotiations is going to be the number of years. I don't think Houston wants to be paying Chris Paul like $50 million when he's 38 years old. But at the same time, you know how this works, Doug. I have no doubt that when they convince Chris Paul to opt into his contract, there was an understanding of where Houston would go with his salary. So I think they know what they're going to have to pay Chris Paul to stay. I just wonder if it's 4 years or if they have to go the full five.
There's also talk Draymond Green not wanting to take a low ball offer, not wanting to take a penny less than the max contract that he will be supermax. He'll be eligible for coming up to next year. Golden State's obviously going to change their bench. Is there any thought that they change one of the Hampton Five?
No, none whatsoever from what I hear. Everything I do, when I talk to people in Golden State, the message that comes out is just, we think if we tinker with the bench, you know, get younger, maybe bring in like the 2018 version of David West, somebody that hasn't won a championship that could help kind of fuel that locker room, that they'll be okay. And look, the NBA has to fix their extension rules. Like, a guy turning down an extension becomes a story, but the financials of it, Doug, are so stupid that nobody ever signs an extension unless they're so desperate to guarantee money that they're willing to do it. I mean, when they get to this, is off topic a little bit, but when they get to the next collective bargaining agreement, they've got to figure out a way to make extensions palatable for players, because, you know, none of these deals that guys could be offered make any sense.
Right, and it makes them look like they're not all in on their team, like it did with Kawhi Leonard, with Kyrie Irving, when Kyrie Irving would be foolish financially, as he stated, to sign an extension, even coming off a knee injury.
It's just dumb. I mean, he'd leave like $80 million on the table. I mean, what player on the level of Kyrie or Draymond or Klay Thompson is going to do that? I do think the NBA knows it's pretty dumb, and I think they're open to tweaking it and making it more realistic for guys to sign those extensions. But right now, it becomes kind of a false story in some ways. The guys aren't, you know, not all in on their team because they're not willing to leave, you know, $80 million on the table. They're just being smart financial people.
Chris Sabanix is an NBA insider for Yahoo Sports. Check out his show noon to 3 Eastern time every Sunday, along with Caron Butler, an NBA champion on Fox Sports Radio. Manix, thanks so much, man. Great work.
You got it, Doug. Anytime.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com and within the iHeartRadio app.
So, look, the Tyrod Taylor being the starter, I expect that for longer than most of these other starters, you know, even incumbents, before the young guys get a shot. I think there's this, if you take one story and you cut out all the other factors, right? Like, let's take Lamar Jackson. So Lamar Jackson runs around, freak athlete. They use him some with Flacco in these OTAs. put him under center some. A couple of the Ravens come out and like, look, that's like a young Mike Vick when he's running around. So if you just take that those quotes, you're like, wow, maybe Lamar Jackson is impressing them so much that you got to start him and play him right away. Then you look at some of the quotes. Shady McCoy was Buffalo Bills running back, said, you know, I'm not into rookies, but some of Josh Allen, like that dude, his arm is, he's got crazy, making crazy throws. Just crazy arm talent. Now, again, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that that means they're going to be great or they're going to be busts. And I don't think those guys are lying. I just think this is kind of what we do. It's what we do. We get the shiny new toy on Christmas and we play it and you're like, hey, whatever happened to that? Well, you know what my kids have a fart gun. You know what a fart gun is?
No.
Have you guys?
No. I've heard of whoopee cushions but.
No, Ramos can attest to this. It's from
Despicable Me.
Despicable Me, right?
Oh.
It's dart gun. I said dart gun, you idiot. Right? He actually, the guy invented a fart gun instead of a dart gun, right? So you squeeze it and it's, you know. And I'm sorry, I'm in my 40s and I find it hilarious. Okay? But, you know, like, I remember my kids got that from their grandparents because that's like my family's favorite movie. We got the DVD player in the car and I'm telling you, Despicable Me, I can quote chapter, line, verse, everything in that movie because it was running like on a loop, which is too lazy to take it out of the DVD player, for like a year straight. So my in-laws get my kids a dart gun, fart gun, and it's hilarious. And the other day, I went back into my son's closet. I was looking for something to get out his baseball clothes for a baseball tryout. And what was back there? The fart gun, right? And it went from being the greatest, most clever, I have to have this present ever, to it's collecting dust. Again, doesn't mean Josh Allen's going to collect dust. First thing is, there's a lot of the new shiny Christmas toy. It's set up for these guys to look good. Can you imagine the pushback if Shady McCoy came out and was like, Josh Allen stinks, right? Of course you got to say, and this is no different than in football when the new recruits show up. Or the new transfer plays for the first time. He's always the newest, the latest, and the greatest. And the fact is that if you think that two guys saying Lamar Jackson's a freak athlete, something that we asked and answered, right? That Lamar Jackson didn't even run for people, wouldn't do agility drills. And you know what? That's not really what hurt his stock. It's just not. So him being a freak athlete is a surprise to exactly zero people on earth. Josh Allen being able to throw a football when there's not live defense, it should be a surprise to exactly zero people on earth. You know, we're going to do it in preseason football. Oh, man, he lit up the preseason. Lots of guys have lit up preseason. Lots of guys have even played well for two or three starts. I mean, the Scott Mitchells of the world, the Tim Tebows of the world, the Vince Youngs of the world. So I'd love to go crazy and give you a hot take on why Joe Flacco needs to sit and Lamar Jackson needs to play. But the fact is that as much as Joe Flacco, we know who he is. He's somewhere 20 to 25 touchdowns, 12 to 16, 18 interceptions. Like, that's Joe Flacco. He's got to be better than he's been, but he's clearly better than Lamar Jackson right now. And falling in love with him because during a couple of OTAs, he ran around and showed he's the craziest freak athlete we've ever seen. Isn't a surprise and doesn't really change that narrative.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
The book is called Tiger Woods. It's co-authored by Jeff Benedict and our next guest, Armin Katayan. Armin, of course, you've seen on 60 Minutes, HBO Real Sports, ABC News, CBS News. He's one of the foremost sports journalists actually in business, and he's kind of spent some time with us as just so you know, kind of the setup here at Shinnecock. It's in Southampton, which obviously a huge summer spot for people, New Yorkers with money. Some people do actually live here year-round. I don't know what you actually do because it gets cold and it gets desolate, but a lot of writers and artists and stuff will find a spot on the water. So we're roughly a mile or so from the ocean, and, of course, on the kind of the south part, Southampton, south part of the end of Long Island, not quite out to Montauk. On the course, we're just off of the fairway for the first hole here in the media tent. We have a big screen where we have everybody's scores, And the folks at the USGA have been kind enough to give us, I think, kind of prime pole position here. Remember, the broadcast turns over to Big Fox here in about 9 minutes. You're about to click on Fox Sports 1. This is the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Armie Katayan joins us. So you've written a book digging into all that is Tiger Woods. Let's just start. Give me the impetus as to why. Why did you decide, all right, this is the topic, the guy I want to tackle?
Well, we had done this book previously, The System, Jeff and I, and it was a deep dive into big-time college football. And we were looking for another sort of mountain to climb. And our agent, Richard Pine, suggested Tiger, and we were, you know, kind of thinking, man, I don't know, because there's been so many books written about him and by him and other people. But when we really kind of dug into it, Doug, we were pretty amazed that they were in two categories. One's most of them came out right after Tiger turned pro, and the other ones came out after the scandal in November of 2009, early 2010, when they were published. And there had never been an immersive 360-degree view of his life going all the way back and really trying to put Earl Woods' life in perspective and Coltita, his mom, Tita's life in perspective. And, you know, Jeff and I have done, between the two of us, 25 nonfiction books. So this was it was a big challenge. And, you know, there aren't that many people that are known by one name. And Tiger, for the most part of his career, I'm watching him putt now here, you know, he was the most famous athlete on the planet. But no one had ever done kind of that investigative biography, which we have done. And it's, you know, it's attracted a lot of attention and a lot of praise.
He leaves a birdie putt just short. I mean, you know, he has to line up like 10 feet to the left. It swings back to the right, but still, Tiger is going to, looks like he's going to end up the front nine at three over. Considering how the round started and considering some of the other scores, might actually take it as a win. He is hitting the fairways. He hasn't been hitting the greens until about midway through this round so far. So we'll keep an eye on Armie Katayan, our guest on the Doug Gottlieb Show. So when you first said, all right, We're going to do a biography on Tiger Woods. Where was he in terms of his body, his injuries, his rehab?
That's interesting. It was the end of 14, the beginning of 15, so he was pretty much a mess physically.
Yeah, 13 he had a great year. He just didn't win any majors.
Right, and, you know, he was on his way back, but his back, you know, was giving out on him. He was a mess physically. There was, you know, a lot of question marks as to whether his career was going to continue, certainly at the heights that it was before. And, you know, it was a risk. I mean, Jeff and I, you know, Simon and Schuster decided they wanted to back us. And we told them, he said, we need 3 years. We need time to dig into everything that's ever been written about him. We read, between the two of us, some 20 different books, everything that had been written by golf writers that are in this room, by Earl, by Tiger himself. We annotated those books. And then we made a massive timeline, which I think was a critical part of our reporting. We went all the way back to Manhattan, Kansas, when Earl was born. And we not only took the big mile markers of his life, of Tiger's life, but we really were able, in our own interviews, some 250 interviews with people from every walk of his life, we were able to slot in things that were happening around Tiger during those epic periods, whether it was the 97 Masters or the 08 U.S. Open or when he signed big commercial endorsement deals, and that really helped us. And then we did what we do, and we went out and found and then gained the trust, which is the time that we needed, we felt, for that three-year period, to get a lot of people that had never talked about Tiger before, their relationships with Tiger. People like Alicia O'Meara, who Mark O'Meara's first wife, who was really a second mother to Tiger when he moved to Isleworth and had a very strong influence on Tiger and was very close to Tiger. Dina Gravel, who was Tiger's first true love. They met when he was a junior in high school at Western High School in Anaheim, California. And their story of how they fell in love and how they broke up in a heartbreaking way was a big part of the early part of the book, because these stories tell you something about Tiger, and they also tell you something about the influence of Earl and Tita, who were profoundly, they were huge influences on Tiger's life.
Incredibly impactful. On his life. Yeah, look, and anybody's parents are, but especially, we thought especially Earl, right? And which is fascinating because, as the story is told in the book, Earl Woods is in an unmarked grave in Manhattan, Kansas.
Yeah.
Here's the, you know, there's two fathers that are synonymous with taking an athlete, both from, by the way, in Southern California, and in this guy, I guess three athletes, and making them into every type of prodigy that you could ever think, and achieving even more of the goals than ever thought possible. Earl Woods and Richard Williams,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And Earl Woods is in an unmarked grave in Manhattan, Kansas.
Yeah.
How does Tiger allow that to happen?
Well, I'll tell you how it happens. In when we found out about it, I actually sent a guy named John Parton, who is the editor-in-chief of the Kansas State Collegian. I said, John, would you just go over to the gravesite? I know he's at Sunset Cemetery in Manhattan, Kansas, and he calls me back like 3 days later, and he goes, you're not going to believe this. I'm like, what? Earl's buried in an unmarked grave. If you don't know where the markers are in the ground, you'll never find Earl Woods' grave. And I'm like, what? And so I called the sexton of the cemetery, Mike Moeller. Jeff Benedict called him, and that's how the book opens, and with Earl's grave being dug. And the reason is, we believe, is Earl did not treat Tita with a great deal of respect. You know, he was a wanton womanizer. Mm-hmm. He was verbally abusive to Tita at times, and we have people who were eyewitnesses to those kinds of episodes inside the house at Teakwood. And he didn't treat her with a great deal of respect. And Tita, everybody looks at Earl as the profound influence in Tiger's life. I'm telling you that Tita was just as influential. She was the one that gave Tiger the iron will and the cold-blooded assassin on the golf course. Because when they would go back and forth either to the practice range or to tournaments, she would be in the car telling them, you know, you don't just beat them. You take their heart. You step on their neck. So they remember when you beat them. So the next time you play them, that's in their head. And we saw that, you know, time and time and time again, Tiger did that on the course. I mean, he had, you know, he broke people's will. That wasn't Earl Woods. Earl Woods was the softy. Tita was the one who had that heartlessness to her when it came to competitive golf. And that is Tita's revenge as far as we're concerned, because Tiger would never go against his mother's wishes. And if you know anything about Earl, and you do, Earl would have wanted a band playing 24/7,
sure. Yep.
A spotlight. Here lies the great creator of Tiger Woods.
Right. There's a little of, you know, a little of Earl Woods in LeVar Ball, for example.
Yes.
Right. You know, LeVar Ball is a bad incarnation, a copy of a copy of a copy, if you will, of what Earl Woods was like. Armin Katayan is our guest. The book is Tiger Woods. He's joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show here live from the 118th U.S. Open at Shinnecock Hills. Why did he get married? I've always wondered. Like, who was the guy? You had to know that Tiger had this part of Earl in him, that he had some hound in him. Everybody says, you know, he was kind of a geek at Stanford in high school, and now he reaches superstardom, and all of a sudden women are throwing themselves at him. Why did people let this happen? Because that really was kind of the disaster that started the downfall of his career.
Yeah, he was all of that. He was a total geek in high school. He stuttered till the age of 7. He was the only child, the lonely child, growing up in Cypress, California. Had no game when it came to women. But think about where he was in 2000, where he's 25 years old, and he's making upwards of $100 million a year. He's in Vegas with Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley. Vegas is exploding at that time, where the high-end bottle service and the high-end nightclubs like Light and Tao and Pure and Bank were all just really starting, and they were on fire. And so Tiger would go into these clubs, particularly Light, because that was where he had a lot of juice there. And you know, he'd sit in a VIP spot right next to the dance floor, and his VIP host would just say, come up to some pretty girls at a nearby table and say, Tiger Woods would like to meet you. And then they would sit down. And Tiger slowly but surely became more comfortable around women. But by 2004, you know, he's in full swing as a man. Girls are throwing themselves at him, and he's catching a lot of them. I don't really know, and I think that's a very good question. I think part of it was because Elon was the perfect image of what maybe his mother and his father in corporate America and his sponsors would look at and say, wow, look at that. She's beautiful. She's smart. She's Swedish. She fits the profile to a T. But the truth is Tiger really didn't slow down much after he got married. And his life accelerated And I think that's one of the great parts of the book is because it's so well reported, and it's almost in slow motion. As we know what happens. We know he hits the fire hydrant on November 27, 2009. That's when he goes off the cliff and the epic fall from grace begins. But by 2000 and 2001, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you see his life accelerating off the course and his isolation and his entitlement and his lack of appreciation of people, his need for absolute privacy. He becomes a diver because he wants to go into the ocean. And he's a great diver. He's a cave diver. Not a lot of people know that. He's a spear fisherman, but he's one of the best spear fishermen around. But he loves the water because, as he said, the fish don't ask for autographs. It's quiet down there. And Tiger was seeking that. But when he went out into that world, you thought he had this picture-perfect marriage because it was presented by people who profited from it as a picture-perfect marriage, meaning Tiger, Nike, American Express, Accenture, Gatorade, General Mills. I mean, it was a who's who of Fortune 500 companies that bought into Tiger's image, which made that fall from grace all the more calamitous for him.
And in fairness,
I say one thing?
Yeah.
It's so easy to be judgmental and for us to sit here and say, how in the world could he do that? But you're talking about a level of fame that's unbelievable.
And what people, I think, don't understand is he has lived through kind of two different generations. The Jordan and Barkley generation, we didn't care about what guys
You're absolutely right.
did in their personal lives. And then all of a sudden we got religion and we did care.
Well, what happened too is, Doug, is that TMC hit the
TMZ,
you know,
yeah.
and you know, the National Enquirer, became a little they were
the
right there. But TMC changed the culture. The social media blew up.
In the book, is there what actually happened that night?
Yeah, that's kind of how the first chapter opens, is Tiger is behind a bathroom door in his house. I won't say cowering, but he's been discovered. The secret life that he's been leading has been discovered because Elon, when Tiger went to bed that night, looked at his cell phone because 2 days before, the National Enquirer had come out with a story that talked about Tiger's secret rendezvous with Rachel Yucatel in Australia.
I do grocery shopping.
Yeah.
My house, I remember it.
Yeah.
And I remember going like, what?
Yeah. And Rachel had denied it. She had gone, and we report this in the book, she had gotten on the phone with Elon. She was put up to it by Tiger's people to deny that she was having an affair with Tiger when she was. And truth be told, they were very close, Rachel and Tiger, at that time. And, but when the discovery was made and Elon was on the phone with her on that Wednesday, and then she saw this text, and, I've been married for 38 years. This is not a text you would want your wife to find, which is, you're the only one I've ever loved, texting from Tiger to Rachel. So Elon makes the phone call to Rachel, not knowing it's Rachel, but when she hears Rachel's voice, she's got a distinctive voice, she was like, I knew it was you. And Rachel was like, oh, you know. And that's where Elon woke Tiger up. He ended up fleeing into the bathroom, leaving the house in a rush, and running into that fire hydrant. So that was the beginning of the end.
She come after him with the golf club?
Well, I mean, he didn't come after himself with the golf club.
Was she trying to free her husband?
Yeah, that was the story.
I remember I was at ESPN at the time. We were getting ready to do college basketball, and people were like, wait, did Tiger Woods die in a car accident?
Yeah.
Like, what in the heck happened? Armin Katayan joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. The new book is Tiger Woods. You can pick it up anywhere. Books are, of course, available. Amazon, super easy. Get delivered to your door. Cowherd says he read it in a day.
Yeah.
Is it Books on Tape yet?
It's on tape too.
I'm going to do the books on tape. I drive a lot. I'm going to do the books.
Call me because there's a couple of mispronunciations in there that Jeff and I were like Jordan Spieth, and we're like, what?
Yeah, it's not the voice of Armin Katayan or Jeff.
No, I turned that one down. I was like, I'm done at this point.
I'm done. Okay. Is he back? Like,
there back, was back, so, back.
Yes,
he's a different person, Doug. I saw him at least from afar. I saw him at Torrey in January, and it was the first time I'd ever seen him that engaged with fans, that appreciative, that open, that human, And it's funny, I ran into somebody here today at the golf course. Her name is Deborah Ganley, and she's a San Diego police officer who is Tiger's personal, one of his personal security people when he's at Torrey Pines. And I saw Deb right as Tiger was teeing off on one. And I said, she said, oh, I love the book, blah, blah, blah. And she said, you know what? He hugged me the last time I saw him. She's known him for 15 years. He's never hugged me before. He hugged me at the last time he saw her at Torrey in January, which is how the book kind of ends in the last chapter or so. And I do believe he's changed. I think what happened last Memorial Day weekend in Florida when he was the DUI, that picture that just ricocheted around the world, everybody was calling me, go, God, did you see the photo? I'm like, yeah. And the word time and time again was sad. God, this is sad. I'm like, yeah, tried writing a book for 3 years and trying to figure out an ending at this point in time. But I think that changed him. I think that moment was a pivotal moment in his life, and he came back healthy. You know, obviously, his back, the fusion has worked. But I think he's mentally happier, emotionally happier than he's ever been. And God bless him. You know, he's 42 years old. He's been through at least two lifetimes, I mean, with his life. And I think he deserves some happiness. I don't think it. I know he deserves some happiness in his life with his kids. And he seems for the first time to really appreciate what's happening around him. Is he back as a golfer? I don't know. That's still to be determined. I mean, he looked pretty damn good in the Memorial and in other places early in the year. I think this tournament's going to be a real telltale sign because, my God, it's so hard out there.
It's so hard. And, you know, considering how poorly he putted 2 weeks ago,
yeah,
to all of a sudden fix that, in with surfaces that, I mean, it are almost impossible to putt on. That you're asking a lot of a guy, but we'll see. He's not only considered the best iron player in the history of golf, he's also maybe the best grinder in the history of golf. Right to where,
yeah,
he can play a poor round and find a way to get around par, just keep himself so that if he can put together two good rounds.
His putter was of all the things, you know, that was always a difference maker. He made
6 foot in, he was money.
Yeah, and I mean the putt he made it in 08 at the Open. That 12 to 15 footer that nobody could believe. Excuse me. He's just, you know, we'll see. I mean, it's going to be interesting to watch for sure.
Armin, great stuff. The book is outstanding. I'm going to do the book on tape. I'm not going to lie to you and said I read it in one
Thank
day.
Thank you for saying that.
But thanks so much for joining
you
us.
You bet, bud. Thank you.
All right, Armin Katayan, who, man, I've known a long, long time. He wrote about a little piece about, had Bra Recruits, another book you should pick up and read about the high school, college recruiting back in the day. This is the Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. Armin Katayan getting all choked up over our book.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com and within the iHeartRadio app.
Landon Donovan joins us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. Landon, World Cup underway. We saw Russia go out and get the first win for the home country. Let's start with the news yesterday, which was huge. The Spaniards sacked their manager 2 days before they're going to play their first game because he didn't tell them he was taking the Real Madrid job. That seems like a bizarre overreaction. Am I overreacting calling it an overreaction?
I think it's very much an overreaction. I think if I've learned anything in the soccer world over the last 20 years, it's that people are really, really emotional about this sport, and so they make decisions emotionally instead of rationally or practically, and this clearly fit that bill.
Okay, so help me out with how integral a coach or a manager's decisions are after the game actually begins, right? I know that there's tactics, I know that there's adjustments, but a lot of it comes down to style and picking the pieces and picking the players. How much do you think this actually affects the Spaniards when they go out and play?
It's a great question, and I think, as you know, it depends manager to manager or coach to coach. Some teams, and you see this kind of in baseball a lot, some teams sort of police themselves and are their own, you know, they have leaders on the floor who are extensions of the coaches. Spain is a team that's very mature, very veteran, a lot of older players, so they don't have a lot of guys who are going to be really shocked by this, or, well, they may be shocked, but they're not going to be affected by it. So I think if there is a type of team who can handle this, it's a team like Spain. But there's no question, the last thing you want going into a tournament like this is instability, right? So it's just a bizarre situation. I mean, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in some of these conversations to figure out where the real truth is.
Yeah, and it's not like he took a bad job. He took the best job in the sport. And, you know, it wasn't like he took some job, you know, in Belize and wanted a startup thing. Or he agreed to be the French team's manager in the next World Cup. Like, he took the Real job. Help me out. We got like 2.5 minutes left. And I apologize for pinching you on time. How do we fix U.S. soccer? Like, I'm not saying that you'd be in charge.
You want to do that in 2.5 minutes?
But we were making steps, but we still have lacked the step of getting. You know, we had to go and get Americans who weren't really Americans instead of kind of building. Don't we have the athletes within our own borders to build a good enough program to compete internationally?
Sure, but what's happened is at the very top level, we were making progress, but underneath, sort of when you pull the curtain back, there were signs all along and red flags all along that all of us, myself included, missed and weren't paying attention to. And so eventually, it was going to catch up, and it caught up to us. And so from a long-term perspective, the only way you prevent this from happening is by producing and developing players who are capable of getting the job done at this level. I mean, that's period, end of story. So that's where our focus needs to be.
Okay, so how do we do that? How do we get, like, listen, we have so many kids going out for other sports that I believe athletically have more speed, more lateral agility. They don't have the soccer skill, or they don't have the ability to get to the club sport at the youth level. How do we fix that?
Well, the biggest problem in our country, Doug, is that soccer is a sport that has become for the elite, or the wealthy, sorry.
Yep.
And so a lot of athletes who can't afford to pay $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 a year to be part of a youth soccer club say, well, then I'll go pick up a basketball, or I'll go pick up a football. And that happens time and time and time again. And until we fix that and make it more accessible to everybody from every walk of life, every economic background, then we're going to struggle.
Considering how it ended with you and the U.S. men's national team, are you at peace when you watch the World Cup, or does it still not sit well with you?
No, I'm at peace, but I went through, you know, weeks and weeks of grieving and sadness and being obviously disappointed by all of it. But at this point, I'm a fan like everybody else, and I want to see us all succeed.
Hey, Landon, I really appreciate you joining us. I know you're a dad. I know you're playing for Lyon. More than anything, you're a great resource. Thanks for joining us.